This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. 1 year ago today, this was the scene at Staples Center in downtown Los Angeles. That morning, in a thick bank of fog, a helicopter had crashed into a hillside in Calabasas, killing 9 people. L.A. Laker great Kobe Bryant and his 13-year-old daughter Gianna among them. When the news hit, Laker fans embarked on a pilgrimage to Staples Center.
Man, it's Kobe, dude.
Jamal Womble was one of many Kobe fans who rushed over. The 5'10", 230-pound former running back was choked up. His idol was gone. He brought roses to honor his legacy.
As an athlete, man, growing up, you know, he was an idol. Kobe, man, he was different. You know, his mentality, it kind of, he was everything you want out of a competitor. And I think this is just the first athlete to die that I grew up with. You know, I'm only 28, so yeah. I've watched him my whole life. So it's just, you know, it's tough, man. Yeah. Yes.
1 year later, Kobe's legacy continues. From a Bryant-dedicated Lakers championship win last year to Kobe's face smiling down from all the murals around town. KCRW's Angel Carreras tells us more about how Kobe's memory is still visible in L.A.
Close your eyes. Imagine an image of Kobe Bryant. You know, those sharp cheekbones, the direct eyes, the confident chin-up, chest-out posture, the symmetry of his face. If you can visualize him easily, Atiba Jefferson is one reason why. Photoshoot by photoshoot, Atiba Jefferson has helped build Kobe's public image, from rookie to retired superstar. Jefferson's a photographer who's been capturing big-name skaters, riding rails, and sports figures in their prime for over 20 years now. But Kobe, that's his guy.
Kobe, it was cool because we were both, you know, honing our craft at the same time. So, you know, I was able to see him grow up in front of my camera.
They met on a photo shoot at a mansion. It was 1999, before Kobe was an NBA champ and, you know, Kobe. The two were close in age and coming up in their respective fields, going through the same stuff. Both loved skateboarding too. They shared a joke around, but no one to get down to business and perfect that business work ethic, beginnings of the mama mentality, they kicked off a long-lasting personal and professional friendship.
I think of it as, I'm very lucky to have the opportunity. So, you know, being able to be a part of Kobe's journey is just the biggest honor. And, you know, I always knew I was lucky to be able to be there for it. So I never took any opportunity I had for granted when I was able to shoot him.
Among the images Jefferson took of Kobe over the years, rookie Kobe resting his palms on his knees with a focused, steely gaze. Olympics Kobe, draped in the American flag proudly. And dad Kobe, leaning his back against his daughters, Gigi, in matching black Mamba sweaters.
He's one of those subjects that never takes a bad photo. Straight up. You didn't really have to direct him much. He knew the camera. He knew what he was doing. You know, besides hold the ball here or dribble here, he knew what he was doing.
Jefferson was devastated when he got the news of Kobe's passing. He was in Milwaukee at the time, shooting up-and-coming NBA superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo, a player Kobe mentored, and flew back as soon as he could. This one hurt. Kobe inspired Jefferson, sure, but Jefferson was only beginning to capture the paternal years of his friend and his family. He had just shot pics of Kobe and teenage Gigi a few months prior.
I didn't think, you know, that would have been the last time that I would have shot a picture of Gigi, just because I have so many from him winning championships and them being together.
Since Kobe's death, others have taken those images and spread them far and wide, keeping his image and legacy alive. Now they're not just in magazines or at the flick of the Instagram thumb, but painted too, on walls people pass by every day.
Really, it's the mural stuff, the mural culture, which is awesome. I love that stuff.
Drive by any of the more than 250 Kobe murals here in LA, and odds are that photorealistic one you're standing there slack-jawed and gawking at is painted by Louis Palsino, aka Slow Motions. Slow Motions has about 17 murals around town. He'll take a photo like those from Jefferson and use them as a jump-off point, puts his own stamp on it.
I make it an original, you know, I don't just copy a picture. I put my own twist to everything. You know, it's far from copying, you know, there's a lot of imagination that goes on and creativity. So
head off Pico and South Grand downtown, and you'll come across a good example painted on the wall of a fitness center. It's Kobe and Gigi in a pose from a picture of the two at a basketball game. They take up the whole building. They're embracing as angels, adorned with wings and a saint's gold halo. And they're photorealistic too, rendered with obsessive attention to detail. Slow's been a Kobe fanatic since day one. His artistic output and work ethic is inspired by the man and the Mamba mentality. But it's not just that or the championships Kobe brought to the Lakers that endeared Slow to him.
Kobe to me, you know, was like a hero to me and was like kind of like a father figure or like just a good role model figure that I've never really had too much. So, man, so like he meant like the world to me. He was pretty much the only person I highly looked up to. So he meant like everything to me. So yeah, that was like the one of the hardest blows I've ever took with just a celebrity passing or just once he passed, my childhood passed. I felt like a part of my childhood was taken from me, you know, so it struck me in the heart.
When Kobe passed, Slow was paralyzed with grief, but Kobe was his idol. Was he going to let that sorrow consume him or what would Black Mamba do?
Yeah, so I just, you know, put motions to the side as best as I could. And then I got busy.
He tells me he hasn't taken a day off since Kobe passed. Aside from the murals here in LA, he's done some in San Diego, Orange County, for businesses, even in people's houses and backyards. And he's never not working at perfecting his craft, the Mamba mentality.
I literally don't waste any time. You know, I'm always thinking, I'm always creating. If you don't see me with the pen, pencil, or spray can, or any type of art material, there's a lot going on in my head.
The reactions to murals, the process of creating them, it's been therapeutic for him and others.
People tell me that all makes me sad, it made me cry, or, you know, I've had, when I was working at the one in downtown, I had people crying. I had, like, grown men come up to me crying and you know, everything, man. So, and I have people saying it just makes them so happy and, you know, it's so tragic.
Mike Asner wants more people to have this experience. He's the Kobe mega fan behind KobeMural.com and an Instagram of the same name. He's made it a lot easier to find these murals turned shrines with an interactive map to immediately connect the art to the people.
I was just incredibly fortunate to have gone to games at the Forum and Staples Center. These are memories that, you know, I'll cherish forever. And that's why it's led to this project. What can I do to give back in some small way? What can I do to channel my energy into something positive? Honestly, it's therapeutic. And I know it's therapeutic for the fans to see these works of art and to visit them. It's therapy for the artist as well. And it's just as much therapy for me to do something to give back.
According to Asner's interactive map, Kobe's image has made its way everywhere from his former stomping grounds in Italy to Kazakhstan.
We live in a challenging time, and obviously it's been a challenging few years and a challenging 2020, but I have noticed a lot of love out there. And I want to make sure people hear that, you know, people are sharing their love around the world.
And besides the hundreds of Kobe murals here in LA, there's 300 in the country and over 100 more worldwide. And in the years to come, that number is going to grow. And so will Kobe's legacy. Slow Motions and the artists, photographers, wordsmiths, and more will make sure of that.
His legacy still continues. So, you know, through us, through the people we inspired, so it's not over. You know, like they say, you officially die when you're forgotten, you know, and I think he's living through all of us, through every single person he's ever inspired.
For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
Well, Kobe and his 13-year-old daughter were on their way to her basketball game when that helicopter crashed. For young athletes and their coaches, it was a gut punch. But they also, over the past year, have continued to play. And now, even with an ongoing pandemic, coaches are finding ways to use that drive and that persistence to inspire young players to keep playing. Natalie Gutierrez is a basketball coach at LA Valley College, where she's known, by the way, all over the place as Coach Nat. She also coaches for the Clippers youth basketball and a former coach in the Mamba League that Kobe started a few years back. Coach Nat, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
A year ago, Awful day. Do you remember where you were when you heard the news?
I do. Of course I do. It was an extremely tough day. I actually was in the middle of a tournament with my young girls. I coach club as well, so we were a part of a tournament at Sierra Canyon, and I was actually out picking up lunch for our team and the coaches, and on my way back, I receive a call, and they tell me what happened, and I had to pull over. I had to park. It was extremely tough. Then after about 30 minutes, I resumed my drive to the gym, and when I got there, walking into the gym, it was just a complete different environment. You can feel the tension in the air. You can feel the sadness, right? Because there were games going on. And I actually had a championship game planned that same day in like an hour after receiving the news. So it was tough to say the least, but you know, it was my girls that really got me through. You know, one of my girls sent me a text and she said, "Coach, I'm excited that we have this game. You know, I'm ready to play with the Mamba mentality." And when I read that, I was like, wow, I can't be sad. You know, I have to be there for these girls. They inspire me. I inspire them. And we proceeded actually to win the championship that day. So it was actually really great. And yeah.
I mean, basketball coach is obviously very important to you. You're a player yourself. When did you realize you wanted to coach and why youth leagues?
Right. Well, I played community college basketball, and on one of my teams, they would nickname me Coach Nat because I was just always very verbal on the court. And as of then, it just stuck with me. And I had a mentor who really taught me how to interact with kids and really showed me my passion, because ever from a young age, I've always been very empathetic and I've always been quick to develop relationships with the youth. So from that point on, I had my first job coaching club. And that went swell. Then I got another job coaching middle school. And then I just kept going from there. And as through my years and through the experiences that I went through, I learned that it was a passion of mine. And I learned that I was really great at what I did. So that's why I've stuck with it.
You've been a coach in the Mamba League, as I mentioned earlier. This is this 8-week program in LA and New York that has a partnership with some corporate sponsors, Nike, and also with the Boys and Girls Club of LA. Tell us how you got involved with the Mamba League.
I've always been a huge Kobe Bryant fan, and I've always wanted to do something that connected me with communities in need and communities who need opportunities to involve themselves in sports. And Mamba League really did that, and that resonated with me. So the moment that I knew that I could connect with them and be a part of, you know, what they represented, I had to. So once I did that, it was an extremely, extremely great experience.
Did you ever meet Kobe himself?
Yes. Yes, I did. I met Kobe. It had been a dream for me to meet Kobe. And I basically manifested it. I manifested meeting Kobe because from a young age, I've always thought, wow, when will I meet him? What will I be doing? Will I ever get the chance to? And I knew when I did the Mamba League, I felt it in my bones that through this experience, I was going to be able to meet him. And it wasn't until the very last day, basically, of the Mamba League, the last tournament of champions, basically, where I was able to bring my team because we had won first place within our league. So we won first place within our league. We were then invited to this tournament where he was a surprise guest. So he showed up and I wasn't expecting it, but I was like, yes, this is it. This is it. Like, and I saw him in person and I saw an opportunity for me to just kind of cross the lines and walk next to him. So I actually did that because the coaches weren't necessarily allowed to, you know, interact with him. But I saw my opportunity. I had a polo. You know, I had my Mamba League polo on. I looked official. And it's all about confidence, right? You have to walk the part. Yeah, so I saw my path directly to him, and I took it. I walked confidently past everyone. And as I approached him, I was just like, I interacted with him. And I said, oh, my God, like, Kobe, my name's Natalie. I just wanted to tell you that I appreciate you so much for this opportunity. And at that moment, Gigi was also with him. So I was giving him all this praise, and I asked him for a picture, and he took it with me. He was extremely kind, and he said, yeah. So we took a selfie together, and then once I realized I was giving him so much praise, I looked over at Gigi, and I was like, you know what? I'm so sorry. I don't know why I'm giving your dad all this praise. It's all about you now. Forget about him. And when I said that, he gave a little chuckle, and she smiled, and I also took a picture with her, and it was an incredible experience. And it kind of gets me choked up talking about it, because that was the last time that I was able to interact with them, right? And it was, yeah, it's just something that I cherish and I will cherish forever.
Did you grow up in LA?
I did.
So Kobe's like, I mean, indelibly connected to this town.
Yep, that's the culture.
You grew up watching him. Living and working in LA and being in this industry as a player and as a coach, I mean, how do you feel his career, like watching him? He was just a kid when the Lakers got him, right? And he just blossomed.
Yeah, I mean, he joined the league at 17 years old, and he joined the league in 1996, and that's when I was born. So I was born in 1996, and I always feel like that's a connection that I have with him, you know, the beginning of his journey and the beginning of, you know, my life. And it wasn't until, obviously, maybe when I was 10 that I started watching Laker games and seeing him ball out on the court. And even now I think about it, because I lost my dad at a very young age, and I've been reflecting as to why I feel so connected to Kobe. And it was almost as if he was a father figure to all of us. You know, he was that leader. He was someone that we looked up to. And for me, I looked up to, obviously, his game, and a lot of his game I put into my own personal game. But, you know, throughout the years, it went on beyond the court. So his inspiration, or his dedication to the women's game, his inspiration and motive to help his girls develop and become the best versions of themselves, that's just one thing that really stuck with me.
And here we are, Coach Nat, in a pandemic, and you try and adapt, right? And you've been able to do this. I guess you've been doing some drills on Zoom. I can't even imagine what that's like.
Yeah, it's tough to say the least. I mean, you really have to think about the drills that you're creating, and you really have to think about a way where you can keep the kids engaged, because it's really difficult teaching and expecting them to, you know, focus while watching a screen and still, you know, participate as hard as they would if they were in person. But as you said, it's all about adapting. It's about adapting and coping and simply getting them to, you know, communicate and express themselves amongst, not only to me, but amongst, you know, their friends. It really helps create a safe environment, regardless of it being through a box, you know. And once I've established that commonality and that familiarity within one another, then I'm like, okay, all right, now are you guys ready to work out now? Like, can I get started? And, you know, after a while, after talking, they're like, yeah, okay, I'm ready. Like, they get antsy, like, let's do it. So it's just about figuring out ways to engage them and getting creative with it.
Natalie Gutierrez, basketball coach at LA Valley College, also a coach for the Clippers youth basketball and a former coach in the Mamba League. Coach Nat, thank you.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The pandemic, of course, has taken a big bite out of revenues in LA, but one agency will actually see more money than it had expected. LA County's Public Transportation Authority, Metro, has nearly $300 million more coming in than it had anticipated. The Metro has been making a lot of service cuts during the months of the pandemic, so could that change? Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed, and she's a contributor here at Greater LA. Welcome back, Alyssa.
Why, thank you, Steve.
Where did this money come from? I mean, there are fewer people riding public transit during a pandemic, so it's not from people paying fees, right?
Right, right. This is what a wonderful surprise, right? To find out during this time that you actually have some extra money that you weren't planning on. So let's go back to, you know, last time I was on the show, we were talking about this and we were worried because fewer people were riding transit, of course. And as we've talked about before, there's no way to collect fares on a lot of Metro's buses because you board in the back and the fare collection system is on the front. So some people are just getting on the bus without paying, even though they might have a tap card and they might pay with the tap card when they ride the train, but the buses are still aren't collecting the fares. But we're lucky the way we've structured Metro is that about half of our operating budget actually comes from a sales tax that we voted on several times. We voted on several sales taxes where we voted to tax ourselves for better transit. And that's where we're getting the sales tax money over the last year. I think they really estimated that people wouldn't be buying as many things in LA County, but they actually were. So now we have almost $300 million extra dollars.
Is that a lot of money for Metro, considering what their budget is? I suspect their budget is a pretty large sum of money, right?
Right. So you're looking at about $6 billion for the fiscal year 2021. I have a hard time saying that. I keep saying 2020. And that's down from last year because of changes in operations that they had to make. And not technically, you know, not all of that $300 million is eligible to go directly to transit operations, right? But we have this extra money now where we, you know, thought that we would be in a very precarious financial situation. And now we, you know, have a little bit of wiggle room to maybe restore some of the service that might have been slashed for this upcoming year.
And yet Metro, as I mentioned, has been cutting services because of the pandemic. A lot of people are reluctant to wanting to get on a bus or a train, you know, in close quarters with other people. How big have those cuts been? And do you expect when Metro meets on Thursday, I believe they have a meeting this week, for them to use this unexpected revenue, maybe to get more transit out there, more buses, more trains?
Yeah. So at the end of last year, Metro did move forward on these service cuts that at the time, you know, seemed necessary just based on the financial outlook that they had. But since that time, we've had some other really troubling things happen. You know, we've had a lot of drivers that have gotten sick. I don't know if you've seen in New York, they did this gorgeous memorial of the number of MTA drivers who have died from COVID-19. Just a really emotional moment, just seeing how we have these frontline workers who are, you know, not only on the buses, but actually like moving our buses around, and their lives are being put at risk. So we have drivers who are getting sick. They've had to cut some trips even more. But then remember that we have this wonderful next gen plan, this remarkable strategy that Metro's put forward to put high frequency transit, make it more accessible to more people across the county. So if say we had this extra money, and we also have some federal funds coming in, emergency funding that's put in place by the Biden administration, thank you for that. We could actually, you know, use some of this money to increase frequency, make buses not be so crowded by putting some more buses into service. And then you'd also be able to give people really good options for getting around at a time when they don't have a lot of money. You know, they might not have a job anymore. So let's find a way to give people a way to get around that's safe and reliable.
How many people are still using public transit? I mean, and is it safe for people to be riding buses and trains?
Yeah, we've seen not as huge of a dip as many other cities. You know, I've talked to before about San Francisco. They actually had to close some of their transit systems because they didn't have enough people riding. We still have over 50% of our ridership on buses, a little bit less on trains, people who use them exclusively for commuting to, you know, offices where they could maybe do their work at home. You see the little bit lower ridership on those routes, but we still have people using it. And we still have the people who are using it who are most at risk of getting sick and dying from COVID-19. These maps you see of where the outbreaks are the worst happening in the city are also the places where transit ridership is the highest. So if you think about reopening now, you know, we've got by Friday, you know, dining's going to be open again. You've got people who are going to be going to work and getting places. We're going to need that extra space to not only make people feel safe. You know, we need extra vehicles, extra frequency, but we also want to make sure that we're taking the precautions to keep, you know, the operators, the people who work for Metro safe. So I feel comfortable taking it, but I wouldn't use it for a non-essential trip. just because I want to make sure that the people who need to use it are getting the social distance that they need and making sure that they can protect themselves as they have to go to work.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed and a contributor here, of course, on Greater LA. Alyssa, as always, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's it for this evening. Tomorrow, we're talking about waste again, but this time food. And we'll follow the life of a strawberry. A reminder, we have some weather, some intense rain and mountain snow coming in later tonight through Friday. Flooding and debris flows are a real possibility, especially in recent burn areas, especially along the Central Coast, all the way down to Santa Barbara, where evacuations are already taking place in some spots. So please pay attention to the weather. Join us online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what you're doing, what you're thinking. Subscribe to the podcast, too, at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all had hands in this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Please stay safe and have a great night.